Chapter 11. Being Seen. May you live long enough to know why you were born. Cherokee Birth Blessing. From ninth grade until I finished high school, we lived on Park Street, then Parker Street because we were evicted from the house on Park Street. Parker Street was an attic apartment, tiny, with slanted ceilings and only two bedrooms. My sister Anita had gone to college and got her own apartment. Diane was long gone. She'd gone to Howard University when we were on Park Street and made her home in Washington, D.C. So it was only me and my sisters Dolores and Danielle with my mom and dad. My brother John was never around. We were cut off welfare because they found out that my father was still living with us and he was making a salary. It was not a living wage, but it was a salary. Back in the day, they just cut you off. When we were evicted, we got shopping carts, put in everything that fit, and wheeled over to Parker Street to the tiny attic apartment on the third floor. If I had to carry a shopping cart of belongings up three winding flights of stairs now, I'd not make it. It was that abrupt. We had to get out. I was in the 10th grade when we were forced to make that move. Aside from not paying rent, this is how the eviction happened. My mom and dad got into a brutal, bloody fight with Carlos, the landlord. The fight may have been about the rent. Carlos was Portuguese with a very heavy accent, and it was obvious this was the last straw. He wanted to move a family member into the house and was tired of my parents not paying rent. They would always make promises, then get so behind, he was done. My dad was convinced Carlos was racist. When my dad felt any hint of being seen as less than, he let loose. I understood the man just wanted them to pay the rent. Carlos came by with his wife demanding their money. My dad began to argue with him after he said we had to get out. The argument escalated. My dad had come home that day with a new toy, a machete. He had it wrapped in a towel, newly sharpened. Carlos saw the machete and started screaming that my dad was planning to attack him. He tried to grab it from my dad, who subsequently tried to grab it back. Carlos's wife freaked out and tried to grab it as well. Add my mama, not wanting to be left out, she started grabbing too. It became a game of tug of war with screaming, crying, cussing, everyone yelling different commands in Portuguese and English. Let go! No, you let go! You're trying to kill me! No, I wasn't! I was bringing in the house, motherfucker! It ended with Carlos getting sliced under his arm. My dad's hand, I think, was also sliced, and we were, well, evicted. So relieved was Carlos that we were leaving, it's probably the reason he never pressed charges. At this point, I was trying to leave the last vestiges of my bad behavior behind and was uber-focused on achieving as much as I could. Once again, I hadn't made the connection that my behavior matched the chaos at home. I was a powder keg of secrets. I kept them in because it allowed me to get through my day. I couldn't let what I was feeling out. Any chance I had to be a part of something where I could make a mark, I joined in. Teachers at Central Falls Junior Senior High School and counselors were my lifeline. Mr. Aces, Mr. Yates, Mr. Perkins, Jeff Kenyon, Marion Boyajian. Mr. Aces, who was a doppelganger to Gene Wilder, only smaller, was my science teacher in ninth grade. He was also the musical director and glee club instructor. I drove him crazy. I was just bad. I talked too much. I was the classic theater kid who needed a creative outlet and couldn't find one. So I created it for myself, inappropriately, in class. In other words, I acted out, literally. He was always screaming at me. In ninth grade, he threw me out of his class and they put me in another science class. There was no one in that science class I knew, so it shut me right the fuck up. I didn't have anyone to act out with. A few years later, he came into one of my classes and said, "Viola, I have something for you.
What is it?
He said, I went to a dentist appointment today, and as I was in the waiting room, I see this pamphlet, Viola. And it was a pamphlet for Arts Recognition and Talent Search, a national competition in Miami, Florida, in 5 disciplines, drama, visual arts, dance, music, and writing. Each had its own format. 30 kids in each category were to be chosen for an all-expenses-paid trip to Miami. It was only for kids entering their senior year of high school. You can enter in drama, he said.
What do you get, I asked. He looked through the pamphlet. Scholarship money, I think.
I can't do that. A national competition? The pamphlet was thick and contained a laundry list full of things you had to do simply to apply. As he stood there, I read it out loud, believing with every word I uttered the utter absurdity of it. I had to put together a tape of a classical monologue and a contemporary monologue. I had to fill out a huge application form with an essay, and then, of course, there was an application fee. I can't do that, I repeated.
Well, think about it, he said. When I looked at it, I thought about you.
I thought about you, Viola.
The throwing me out of class was all because he saw me.
He saw what was in me. I kept staring at the pamphlet.
Eventually, I shared the pamphlet and its impossible opportunity with my Upward Bound counselor, Jeff Kenyon. You could call Upward Bound counselors by their first name. You could call Jeff in the middle of the day and say, "Hey, Jeff, I'm having an anxiety attack and I'm in the middle of science class. Can you help me out?" And he would be there. He was always there.
He was the first person who took me and my sister Dolores to a political party gathering so that we understood what political campaigning was all about. He was the first person to take us to the Rhode Island Black Heritage Society so we could learn about abolitionist ex-slaves who could read and write and were instrumental in freeing others from bondage. As white as he was, Jeff taught us a lot about Black history.
He heard me and my sister talk one day in his car and picked up on our ignorance about our own history.
That was it. That was all the impetus he needed to spring into action. He would pick us up in the middle of the week, take us to get some food, talk to us to see how we were doing.
"What's going on?" he asked that week.
"Well, my science teacher," and I told him the story, ending with, "But I can't do it." He was silent. I could see him suppressing anger. He said, "Let me see the pamphlet." He looked through it and then asked, "Why can't you do it?"
"Because, Jeff, I don't have a VHS tape."
"How much are VHS tapes?"
"Well, I don't know, but they're probably..."
"I'll get you the VHS tape."
Silence. "Yeah, thanks, but I don't have the $15 application fee."
"Viola, I will get you a $15 waiver for the application fee."
Silence. "Well, Jeff, I have to film myself doing 2 monologues. Where am I going to film it?"
"Viola, there's a TV station on the campus of Rhode Island College. I know the people in the TV station. You can film the monologues in the TV station."
After a long pause, he said, "You've run out of excuses." And he was right. It was now time for me to, as I've heard Black people say so many times, shit or get off the pot. So I shit. I got my monologues together. I went up to Rhode Island College where Dolores was a student. She was so excited. I kept changing clothes, most of which belonged to Dolores in her room, searching for the right look. I went to the TV station. I filmed my classical and contemporary monologues. I filled out my application. I sent it all in. Free from the chains of my excuses, I was handling my business and exercising my agency instead of sitting around doing nothing. And claiming that agency was a win in and of itself. Thousands applied in that competition for drama alone, and only 30 would be chosen. I didn't believe I had a chance, but I was proud that I did it, that I did the hard, arduous work of applying. I remember walking home from school one day with my friend Kim Hall, as we had done on countless occasions. On this particular day, as we neared my home, I looked ahead in the distance, and all of the sudden I saw my mama running toward us. Not casually jogging, but sprinting top speed like her life depended on it. Now you have to understand, my mama is real country. As she was Olympic sprinting in our direction, I noticed that she did so wearing my brother's shoes. I don't know why she had my brother's shoes on. Probably she couldn't find hers, but as she drew closer and closer to us, we could see clearly that she was going nuts, waving this piece of paper in her hand, sprinting, yelling. It was a Western Union note, something foreign to those younger than Generation Xers like myself. Think of it like a text, but in physical rather than instant electronic form. My mama didn't even take time to catch her breath before revealing the contents of message. You have been chosen to come to Miami, Florida, for the Arts Recognition and Talent Search Competition. I was frozen. Silent. Frozen like I had been as my sisters yelled at me to throw that firecracker out the window. Frozen like when my entire family begged me to jump down from what we thought was our burning apartment. Frozen like when I sat silently all those many times while being lectured by teachers, nurses, and principals about my bad hygiene. But this was a good kind of frozen. A spectacular, glorious kind of frozen. Dumbfounded by the sheer unbelievability of the news my mom was sharing with me. Stupefied by the idea that the work I invested in a crazy dream actually paid off. Astonished that individuals I had never met actually saw me and deemed me worthy to participate in this prestigious competition. I could not for the life of me see myself as one of the chosen few, but of the 1,200 applications, I was one of the 30. I got an all-expenses-paid trip to Miami. I was in. I don't recall exactly what I said to my mother when I broke out of my stupor, but whatever it was accompanied by a lot of screaming, laughter, and tears. I was such a crybaby. That summer, going into the 12th grade, was the first time I flew on an airplane. I felt really out of place in Miami. That trip was one of the biggest things that had ever happened to me. My two monologues were from Everyman and Runaways, which had a lot of great monologues about feeling abandoned. I forget which particular one I performed. It could have been Footsteps, or it could have been the last monologue in the play. They were all delicious in the sense that they provided actors a smorgasbord of feelings and emotions to tap into and share with audiences. And now I had the opportunity to share all those feelings, so many of which came out of my own experiences with the best of the best gathering in Miami. That being said, I felt so out of place around the best talent in the country. We stayed at the brand new Hyatt Regency Hotel in Miami. News outlets were there that week, even Good Morning America. Great actors, dancers, musicians, visual artists from the Toniest Performing Arts School arrived in full regalia. I came with a $30 dress from a store in downtown Pawtucket and a $2 suitcase from St. Vincent de Paul. I was overwhelmed and utterly not prepared artistically. Neither was I prepared socially. These kids were in their bodies, confident, or at least good pretenders, and rowdy. I was none of those things. And on top of that, I was intensely shy. I felt alone. Looking back, I see I had more social anxiety than shyness. I felt that who I really was not worthy of a reveal. I was terrified every time she had to come out. My roommate was a girl from Pennsylvania who talked about winning, who she thought was great, who wasn't. She wanted it. Whatever it was, she would torture herself after every daily audition. I didn't understand. I was just trying to survive. I did great with my monologues. Afterward, it seemed that everyone wanted to know me. Everyone loves a winner. When I had to do my improvisations, which I loved, I froze. There were 5-minute, 3-minute, and 1-minute improvs. After I froze, there was a collective silence that settled over me and the rest of the group. It was a week of 5-course meals, boat trips, television crews, media attention. In spite of the momentary lapse during the improvs, my talent was being recognized. However, my talents and the recognition that came with it were far more evolved than me, Viola. I didn't feel worthy. All the symbols that could give me status, I never had. Now one was within reach. I was named a promising young artist and was lauded at City Hall once I got home. It was a big deal in Central Falls, even though I didn't win any scholarship money. If I created a fable of my life, a fantasy, I see myself finally meeting God, gushing, crying, thanking the Almighty for the accolades, a fabulous husband, a beautiful daughter, my journey from nothing to Hollywood, awards, travel. I can clearly see the Lord's face staring at me, taking me in and saying, "You never thanked me for creating you as you." Chapter 12, Taking Flight. If you want to identify me, ask me not where I live or what I like to eat or how I comb my hair, but ask me what I am living for in detail. Ask me what I think is keeping me from living fully for the thing I want to live for. Thomas Merton. Eventually, I received a full ride to college with the Preparatory Enrollment Program Scholarship. PEP, as we called it, was a sister program of Upward Bound. I started in a familiar place, Rhode Island College, and space, housing in the same all-girls dormitory, Brown Hall, where I'd spent summers in high school and visited my sister Dolores during the school year. I went into college at 17. And like a lot of kids, I wasn't mature. But I definitely thought I was. I was so excited to leave home. I worked for it and earned it. And once I arrived, I unpacked, settled in, and proceeded to fall into a deep, deep depression. Probably the deepest depression I've ever experienced. I haven't had one like that since. Not that deep. I was depressed about being away from my little sister, Danielle, but that separation alone didn't fully explain its depths. Since age 14, I had saturated my life with acting, becoming an artist. But when I found myself in college, I still could not give myself permission to do the thing that I loved. My mind was like a railway station where 2 trains were leaving at the same time. One train was my academic career life. It was on track to graduate from high school, go to college, to get my Bachelor of Arts degree, and become an artist. But the other train leaving the station tracked back to the place of trauma I came from, a place where I was bruised, did not believe in myself, had no sense of self. I could not understand self-love. I never felt like I was enough. I went to college asking myself, as many artists do, how am I going to make money? How am I going to support myself? When I didn't see a clear path, I thought, I'm not going back home. It's just not going to work as an artist. I have to be something else. Acting is just something I'm going to do on the side. So I took a lot of English courses, which I loved, and decided I was going to be a teacher. Something inside me, however, must have had different ideas, because I fell deep and hard into a major sadness. It was a depression about trading in my dream. My dorm, Brown Hall, was all female. It had suites of 12 rooms, and each had a single bed, a desk, and a little closet. The building had a front door and a back door. Whenever someone was at the front door, whoever was manning the front desk would call you and say, "You have a visitor." I was settling into my new life, and despite the weight of the depression, happy to be surviving away from home. I had my room, showers, food, heat. One night during the first year, I got a phone call from my sister Anita, who was crying. "We're at the back door." I came out to find Anita in tears and almost 8 months pregnant with my first niece, Brianna. My mama was with her, also crying, bloodied in the face, bruised. My little sister Danielle reeked of urine. It returned me to the trauma I'd grown up in, that had catapulted me out of my body. My father had again attacked my mom, and they had to get out of the house. So they drove up to Rhode Island College in Anita's beat-up car because they had no place else to go. "You guys can't stay. I can't have anyone in my room." I panicked. I had no idea what to do. "I'll get thrown out of the dorm." "Then we have to go back home," Anita said. "He's out of his mind, crazy. He may kill Mom." I couldn't move. Again, I was frozen. Yet I managed to respond. "I don't have any money. I don't know what to do." My mama was crying, terrified. "Why don't you just keep Danielle here for the night?" Danielle was crying. It was awful. So I took Danielle. I barely had money to do my laundry downstairs in the dorm, but I took my sister anyway, tried to wash her clothes, let her take a shower. My best intentions did not match my resources. She slept with me in my single bed. She slept on one end, I slept on the other. I barely had money for weekend meals when the dining hall was closed, but I somehow fed her. That's all I could do. I was trying to find my way, get my foothold, and also throw a rope to my family. It was trying to save someone else when I was drowning. One of my regrets is the trauma Danielle had to endure and my lack of ability in the moment to do anything about it beyond the temporary band-aid of that night. Now that I have a big bank account, resources, I wish I could reach back to that time period. If I could, I would travel back in time and take my sister away from all that right then and there. She called me at least 15 times a day. My sweet mate would say, "Viola, it's your baby sister." She would almost always be crying, saying, "Come get me, Vali." I always had to say, "Danielle, I can't come. I'm far away by bus." She would then begin openly weeping. Or I would hear my dad's drunken rages in the background while she wailed, "Please come get me." Sometimes, especially on the weekends, Dolores and I would go home to be with her, pool our money to buy Heavenly Hash ice cream, fixings for a Greek salad, and pasta shells with red Prego sauce. Danielle would be so happy. She would run out to us like Celie did in The Color Purple when she saw her sister Nettie. That reaction when you miss someone so much and finally they're right in front of you. We would eat and watch Fantasy Island or The Love Boat. Tattoo, the character played by Hervé Villechaize, would run up to this lighthouse when he saw the plane coming toward the island and would ring the bell shouting, "The plane! The plane!" Danielle loved that part so much she would say in between bites of pasta, "He's gonna say the plane, the plane!" We would tease her and say, "No, he's not. Who told you that?" She would say, "Watch, you'll see." He would say it and our jaws would drop. We would look at her in amazement and she would cross her arms as if to say, "I told you." That was our ritual. We went home because we absolutely loved our baby sister and she loved us so much. Then on Monday, we went back to school. My older sister, Diane, experienced every accolade imaginable during her journey.
National Honor Society, Rhode Island Honor Society, All-State Basketball. In addition, she was a great actress and singer. She could do it all. Successful black women almost normalize overachieving. That was definitely Diane. She started out in acting at Rhode Island College before transferring to Howard University. At Howard, she still wanted to become an actress until she found out how hard it was. "I want health insurance," she told me. Even though my mom and dad didn't go to college, didn't finish high school, Diane had driven it into us that we were going to college. She instilled in us that if we did not have a college degree, if we did not find something to do, if we did not focus, if we did not have drive, we were going to be like our parents. I felt if I did not go to college, if I did not get a degree, if I was not excellent, then my parents' reality would become my own. There was no gray area. Either you achieved or you failed. I loved them dearly, but I didn't want to live a life of poverty, alcoholism, and abuse. I thought I had only two choices: either succeed or absolutely sink. No in between. I had no understanding that I possessed the tools to dig my way out if I somehow made a mistake. I had no understanding that there would be hard times and then joy would come, or sometimes a shoe would fall, but failing wasn't permanent. None of that emotionally healthy thinking was instilled in me. I only understood secrets, suppression, succeeding at all costs, overachieving. You make it or you don't. You either sink or you swim. I don't know specifically how I came into my truth, but I'm pretty sure other caring people had a lot to do with it. Counselors in the Upward Bound program and my sister Dolores, who constantly asked me, "Why aren't you acting?" Until finally one day in my second year, I said, "You know what? I'm just going to do it." That was when much of the depression fell away. The cure was courage. The courage to dare, risking failure. I decided I was going to be a theater major and I was going to be an actor. I made a lot of friends in college. My suite mates were my crew: Jody, Chris, Jane, and especially Terry Noya, because we lived in the same town, Central Falls. Noya was Portuguese and came from poverty like me. Cheryl, the RA, resident assistant, had cerebral palsy, but you almost wouldn't know it, even though she walked with an apparatus, because she was so beautifully tough. They were a motley crew of forward-thinking girls God-ordained to be protective of me. I felt like they all believed in me. We loved one another. We were there for one another when parents died, getting married, having children. One of our suite mates got pregnant while we were still in school and had to drop out, but we rallied around her. We had good times, but that first year was a rough transition. I drank 3 times my first year, and every single one of those times I got caught. I'd go out with friends and drink or whatever, but it wasn't my jam, and I should have known it. It's like our parents would say when we were younger, a hard head makes a soft ass. That means some lessons you have to learn the hard way. The drunkest I got my entire life was in college. Some of my suite mates and I went off campus to the east side near Brown University and did shots of tequila and shots of beer at Spats. Before I knew it, I was crawling out of there. I went back to my dorm, threw up, and had a hangover for a week. I don't know what my jam was, but it wasn't drinking, and I certainly wasn't dating or having sex. The moments of fun for me were when the girls in our suite sat in the common room and talked about everything. College was an interesting experience of not fitting in with the white kids and not fitting in with the black kids. Harambe was a school's black student coalition. Even though I knew a lot of the black folk went to the Ebony Fashion Fair and all of that, I didn't fit in with them because I was from Central Falls
and those black kids were from South Providence or Middletown, areas where there were more black people. It was as if I didn't have my black card. I was dark-skinned, didn't dress worth a damn, and had no swag. None. Hell, I was coming from a square-mile city that was predominantly white when I was growing up, but now had more Hispanics. I didn't even know I had to have a certain behavior to have a sense of belonging with my own race. Yet my card was too black to get with the white kids. I was lost in that in-between space. Mine was a journey getting through college, even after surviving that freshman year depression. I was on my own. There was a food program during the week, but not during the weekends. There it is, food again. There was something about the inability to get food that made me feel that I was slipping back into my fucked up childhood. I always felt like I was foraging for it from Friday evening to Monday morning. Imagine what it's like when you don't have a weekend meal plan. Worse off, you don't have a family who can send you a care package or a home where you can drop in for a kitchen laundry room raid. Imagine you don't have one of those little refrigerators in your room packed with food to carry you through those days when the cafeteria is closed. The result? The hunger pains of poverty. To combat that, I always had a lot of jobs. I worked as an RA and counselor in the preparatory enrollment program during the summer. I always worked. Senior year, I had 4 jobs while in school full-time. I worked in the college library. I worked at the Rhode Island College front desk. I continued working at Brooks Drugs in Central Falls, and I had one other on-campus job. Working at Brooks Drugs required me to leave campus, get on the bus, and schlep to Central Falls. Envision you have to work full-time but don't have a car. So you have to take 3 or 4 buses one way in sub-zero weather to get to a damn job that's 4 or 5 towns away from campus in order to make enough money to eat on the weekend. Then you've got to take 3 or 4 buses back to your dorm room so you can make your Monday morning classes. You've got to graduate. You still have to study. You feel like you're on a treadmill. To this day, I don't like taking the bus. I lived in New York City for 13 years and took the train all the time, never the bus. During college, I walked in cold, freezing weather, at the very least 1.5 miles to the bus stop off campus. Either that, or I'd have to wait for the bus to come to Rhode Island College, and that bus schedule was unreliable. Most times, I just walked to the first bus stop in freezing cold weather. It was especially heinous when it was dark, because I had to walk through the back entrance of the college, over the sports field, then up to Smith Avenue, where there were very few streetlights, and wait for the bus. That bus would take me to downtown Providence. Then I would wait again at a major bus stop for the bus to take me from downtown Providence to downtown Pawtucket. Usually, I didn't have the money for the last leg of the trip, or sometimes, when I had the money, I would miss the bus from Pawtucket to Central Falls because, well, it was unreliable. It was a scheduling nightmare. I would walk 1 or 2 miles from downtown Pawtucket to Brooks Drugs in Central Falls. After work, I would go back to my parents' apartment, sleep on the floor, and go back to school the next morning or take someone else's shift. Working hard is great when it's motivated by passion and love and enthusiasm. But working hard when it's motivated by deprivation is not pleasant. A lot of college for me was great laughter and connection with sweet mates and other friendships I began to make, mixed with isolation and fucking pain. I still felt like I had to hide my deepest truths to fit in. I recreated myself as this other. I imagined myself as this fabulous, overachieving, funny, quirky theater geek from Central Falls. Every once in a while, I sat with the black students in our area in the cafeteria, But most of the time, I sat with my tribe, my sweet mates, or by myself. Rhode Island College was less than 1% other back in the day. Other meaning any student of color, Hispanic, Asian, Black, Middle Eastern, the rest were white. There were probably close to 9,000 students. I was a lost girl trying to find my way. It didn't help that back then, Rhode Island College, RIC, had fraternities and sororities that were rowdy and all white. Kappa Epsilon was one. I mention this because some of those members were blatantly racist. Many years after my college days, I read where some researchers traced the founding of the Ku Klux Klan to the Kappa Alpha fraternity. In hindsight, some of those RIC Kappa Epsilon members must have been kissing cousins with the Brotherhood, emphasis on hood, of Kappa Alpha, because their acts of blatant racism were a constant narrative perpetuated by its members. I think they believed that whites all gained college admission based on merit, while Black and brown students were all beneficiaries of affirmative action. There was no cognitive understanding of the real complexity of race at the school or in its admissions process. How do you excel when you're Southeast Asian, highly intelligent, hardworking, but spent 2 years in a Cambodian jungle, 2 years in a refugee camp, and watched your family being massacred before coming to the country? Without the preparatory enrollment program, there would have been zero students of color because we were starting with major deficits. Most destructive was the view that we weren't worthy. It is the foundation built into the DNA of America. And when you couple it with personal challenges like poverty, violence, trauma, and compromised communities, it can become a death knell. Years later, Frank Sanchez was appointed president and totally transformed the demographics of the school. I focused on acting classes, character study, voice and articulation, creative classes, dramatic criticism, the history of theater, every aspect of the theater. The other academic classes, not so much. I had felt the huge malaise until deciding that acting was the path I was going to take. It's what made me happy. It's what brought me joy. But there was no way in from Rhode Island to being a working actor. None. How do you even get a job? How do you get an audition or an agent? I was getting closer to starting my life and needed to figure it out. The area in life that is parallel to work, to academics, is home. Your emotional center is rooted there. For me, the result was being late for class a lot, not being as prepared as I could be. I was always catching up, always a little disorganized. I lacked organizational skills, even in my room. I didn't know how to dress or present myself. I had the persona of being real because I didn't know what or who else to be. But being real and being transparent are two totally different things. Being real is wearing $15 shoes and being proud to wear them. Being transparent is saying, I'm always anxious. I never feel like I fit in. I need help. I wasn't transparent. I didn't feel like I was in my body. People probably felt I was because I never spoke about my father's alcoholism or growing up poor and hungry. I kept big secrets. I felt like I was the big secret. A huge part of me, my pathology, was a big secret. What I presented to the world was a little Black girl overachiever from Central Falls. And I was. I immersed myself in the theater once I decided that was what I wanted. I woke up one day and said, "Just jump, Viola." I auditioned and got two roles in main stage productions, Hotel Baltimore by Lanford Wilson and Romeo and Juliet. I was the prostitute April in Hot L and the nurse in Romeo and Juliet. For my portrayal of April, I was nominated for an Irene Ryan Award, the top acting award in college. I also created a one-woman show that I performed for years. It had 17 different characters. Every character from Celie in The Color Purple to Pilot in Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon to St. Joan. I even performed an improvisation piece where I created a comic piece based on words the audience just spontaneously threw at me. The one-woman show was my senior thesis project, and the purpose was to show that I had range, that I could transform just like my white counterparts. At the time, I felt it was a show that was a true coming-out event. But in hindsight, the objective of it was fucked up. How do you create a show to prove you're worthy? There's a bartering desperation factor attached to that. Let me prove to you that I have talent instead of just being. Forget about the dark-skinned girl who just walked into the audition room. Let me use my training and technique to make you forget that I'm black. The extent of that obstacle is way more burdensome than the obstacles placed in front of my white counterparts. White students just had to show up and be good. There was no transforming to make you believe that this Rhode Islander could actually be Russian in a play by a Russian playwright. They simply had to be, well, white. This obstacle would be the 400-pound gorilla that would constantly inhabit the various rooms I entered throughout my life. Rhode Island College was known for its great musical productions, but I was never part of that. In fact, if you asked many of the theater students there during that time, they have very little memory of me. I did find mentors in Bill Hutchinson, Elaine Perry, and David Burr. I did mostly black box productions, Reader's Theater, and off-campus summer theater. If there is another pet peeve as a theater major there in the 80s, it's this. Educational theater should be just that. College should not operate like a Broadway or regional theater whose main goal is profit. Educational theater is for the training and preparation of the student actor. Its purpose is to give them the tools to be able to operate on a professional level. It's why we pay tuition. There are and were theater majors who have never done a main stage production. How do you learn if you don't do? I graduated after 5 years because it took me a long time to decide on my major. I had to take some courses to catch up. I stayed on campus the whole time. My last year, I went on national student exchange to California Polytechnic University in Pomona. I went because I wanted to get out of Rhode Island, out of the cold winters. I just wanted a different scene. The greatest surprise of my life is that in one semester, I flourished. I performed in Mrs. Warren's Profession, a George Bernard Shaw play. I was a part of an improv group. I took a life-changing public speaking class. I did very well academically and made wonderful friends. It was the first time I got a weave, which is a big deal back in the day. At the time, I felt cute, real cute. I kept that damn weave in until string was hanging down my shoulder. I loved the theater program at Cal Poly. I totally fit in with all the theater geeks. I had a great roommate, Eva Reina, a tall, wonderful Jewish woman from Hungary whose father owned a bakery in Sunnyvale, California. The nicest family. He would send her boxes of pastries which we would devour. I could eat enormous amounts of food back in the day. I was still painfully shy, uncomfortable, and awkwardly introverted outside of theater. I avoided conversations, avoided dating, still no boyfriend and no sex. It took a lot for me to trust people, to really allow anyone in. My posse was always small because of that. I came back to Rhode Island College for my final semester renewed. Going 3,000 miles away and throwing myself into the belly of the beast that was California forced me to dig deep to survive. I made the dean's list for the fourth time. A month before graduation, I auditioned for grad programs for theater students. They're called URTA, University Resident Theater Association auditions. Even though they're called URTA auditions, no one ever got any work in regional theaters after these auditions. It's another example of the brutality and nebulous aspects of the business of acting. However, schools courted me for their master's programs in theater. Once again, I was a mess of contradiction. I was, on one hand, brave, courageous, able to be independent and out on my own, and at the same time, I was emotionally conflicted, not comfortable in my authenticity, in my own skin. As brave, courageous, independent Viola, I took the train into New York City for my audition without any instruction or research. I just went and auditioned, and it was a great audition. No matter how nervous I was, I could use it as fuel to really attack my monologues, which were Celie from The Color Purple and Martine from the Molière play The Learned Ladies. It was the Celie monologue that always got me in. It would later get me into Juilliard and into a lot of readers' theater competitions in New England. I thought it apropos that Celie was so incomplete, not fully formed. If not for the love from her sister and Shug Avery, she would have never seen her value. When I was on stage, I could ingest the applause, audience member tears, and words saying they were so moved and they never saw a performance like that before. It gave me temporary self-love from the outside, but it would soon wear off because self-love from the outside, by definition, really isn't self-love. So I quickly went back to my ordinary world where I felt awkward. I could handle my quirkiness, pain, shyness when I could put it all in my character. It would be accepted in a way that made me feel even more awkward and not accepted in my real life. I graduated with a degree in theater in 1988. The whole family came down for my graduation from Rhode Island College. My four sisters and my brother, mom, dad, and even my grandmother, Moselle Logan, came from South Carolina. They sat in the bleachers and screamed like banshees when I got my diploma. My grandma kept saying, "I'm so proud of you, baby. Your grandma loved you so much." She was small and dark-skinned. I remember thinking, why am I staring at her so much? Something about her drew me toward her and tattooed itself in my memory. It was her voice. It was deep, clear, melodious. I wanted to freeze this moment in my memory. It was her voice that stood out to me. She had the voice that most actors would die to have. They spend thousands of dollars to tap into it. It was regal. It was commanding. It took me by surprise. It sounded just like me. Chapter 13. The Blooming. Jump, and you will find out how to unfold your wings as you fall. Ray Bradbury. When I graduated from Rhode Island College, a voice somewhere far in the recesses of my psyche, which was always true, honest, and in hindsight, beautifully cognizant, that I didn't have the courage to always listen to, but when I did, it served me perfectly, steered me to apply to a 6-week summer program at Circle in the Square Theater in New York City. I got accepted after my URTA audition in New York. I got a full tuition grant to the 6-week program, but I needed money to live in New York City for those 6 weeks. A great woman ran the Rhode Island State Council on the Arts at the time.
Iona Dobbins. She was dedicated to artists and the arts. I cried in her office begging for money. She listened to my sob story, gave me a napkin, and said, "I'm going to get you the money." And she did. She got me a $1,200 grant. That incentivized me to earn the rest of the money I needed to go to New York and study at this great theater. That summer, a month before the program started, I worked in a horrible factory. To actors who say, "Oh, I don't care, I'm not going to compromise myself artistically, even if I have to live in poverty," I say, "You've never lived in poverty. If you've ever been poor as a child or adult, it's no joke." I worked in factories where those in unemployment offices were sent. You signed up to work in whatever place needed laborers that day. At 6 o'clock in the morning, you crowded into a van and were driven to a factory. In Central Falls, I knew people who worked in factories, people I grew up with. Undocumented immigrants who came with no job skills whatsoever. Even my mother worked in factories. I worked at a factory where you just made boxes. That's all you did. You made boxes. All day long. I worked at another factory and then started working at PPAC, which is the Providence Performing Arts Center, doing telemarketing work, which is horrific. People scream at you through phones. "Stop fucking calling me on the phone. I don't want you calling me. Ba, ba, ba." It was great training for an actress because it's the height of humiliation, the height of rejection. I had a technique where I would always ask for the man in the house if the woman answered. I would use my sexiest voice. Almost always the woman would ask, "Who, may I ask, is calling?" or "Who is this?" Then I had them. I could keep them on the phone. That was all I had in my bag of tricks. My life was topsy-turvy that summer, as I earned enough money to supplement the Rhode Island State Council on the Arts grant so I could go to New York and just enjoy my time doing the work as an actor at Circle in the Square Theater. Once I got to New York, I also got a job passing out flyers in Times Square for Tamara, the living play. It was almost like dinner theater. You walked into a building on Fifth Avenue where you stood and watched the play, a murder mystery unfolding in the room, right there. Then each character veered off to a different room, and you had to choose which character to follow. At the end, the mystery culminated in the same room where it started. During intermission, you were served dinner. A friend, who'd also been a student at Rhode Island College, was the head of publicity. "Viola, I will pay you $20 an hour in cash," she said, "if you pass out flyers about the play in Times Square." So that became one of my jobs during the 6-week program at Circle in the Square. I only passed the flyers out and didn't have any acting role because I was just out of school, didn't have an agent, and newly arrived in New York from Podunk, Rhode Island. I certainly wasn't a professional yet. I thrived at Circle in the Square. I loved, loved, loved New York. I lived in a loft apartment in Gramercy Park with two women I knew from Rhode Island College, Donna and Mary. New York kickstarted the part of me that was always freaking scared. It catapulted me out of my comfort zone. New York was just a different vibe. The crowds, the smell, the noise, the buildings, the life. Men whistling at you as you walk to the subway. And one day, I learned how to ride the train. I just did it. I sampled restaurants and delis owned by people from all over the world. I received my best acting training ever. I've had a lot of wonderful acting teachers: Ron Stetson, Dr. Hutchinson, Rob Dimmick, Elaine Perry, David Burr. But Alan Langdon, in that 6-week program at Circle in the Square Theater that summer of 88, was the absolute greatest I've ever had. I came to life under the tutelage of teachers there like Jacqueline Brooks, great actors like Philip Seymour Hoffman, Felicity Huffman, Kevin Bacon were students.
It was no holds bar, courageous scene study, acting study, voice, movement, everything. It was comprehensive, a training program where you couldn't emotionally hide. Alan himself was, well, a strange man. He was mysterious. Looking back, I think he was just quiet. As artists, we're so used to the flamboyant personalities, and we're almost offended when someone is not that way. Alan's flamboyance was in his intense, quiet observation. There were close to 30 kids in my group, and more than 100 students in total, and you would pair off to do scenes. Everyone was coming from a different part of the country and staying in apartments in different parts of the city. We would go to each other's apartment or sometimes practice a scene on a stoop. We would come in, perform the scene, and Alan would just stare. Then he would get up and stand in the back of the room and then sit again. It was as if he was silently watching a football game and internally getting anxious because his team was close to winning. The scene would end, and there was always deafening silence. He would either ask a series of questions or do something to wake you up. One actor, Emily, who had a very, very soft voice and always looked nervous, was a part of the group that summer. Emily always looked scared. She was enormously sweet and accommodating, almost too much so. She was a part of the program not because she wanted to be an actor, but wanted to find herself. Or heal? From what? I didn't know. An actor brings their story with them in the work. Past, present, fears, mess, humor, trauma. Emily decided to do a scene from the play Agnes of God by John Pielmeyer. The story is about a young nun who becomes pregnant inside the convent. She insisted she had no intercourse and says God impregnated her. There's absolutely no evidence of anyone on the grounds of the monastery or in her room. At a certain point, she begins to bleed from her hands, a stigmata. It becomes apparent that the baby may be a case of immaculate conception. The mother superior calls in a court-appointed psychiatrist to make an assessment. But the conflict in the scene Emily chose is between the insistent logic of the psychiatrist and the passionate insistence of the young nun whose faith in God is fervent. The scene started with the actor playing the psychiatrist who had pinned Agnes, Emily, to the wall, screaming, "Agnes, whose baby is it? Tell me! Tell me!" She's supposed to shout back, "It's God's!" Emily whispered, "It's God's." Barely audible. I cringed, knowing Alan would dig down deep to see what was blocking her. There was the usual silence after the scene. Alan looked at Emily and finally said, "Where's your voice?" Emily was shaking at this point. She said she didn't know. Alan insisted, "You must know. Who took your voice?" Emily and I were really close that summer. We were both painfully shy and awkward, and people like that usually find and cling to each other. We talked about life all the time, and she just kept saying she wanted to get better. Better from what? I didn't know. But even I wanted to know where she lost her voice, why she always looked scared, jittery. Showing intense emotion, she finally said softly, "My father would hold me down on the bed when I was 9 and beat and rape me. He would cover my mouth." The whole class fell silent. My heart raced. Alan asked if she wanted to do the scene again. She wanted to. She was braving something, and it wasn't acting. This class was a tool to unlock a deep pain. To save that little 9-year-old girl. Her scream was a sound of an animal that's about to be slaughtered by a pack of wolves and is calling on every strength left in its body to fight, to live. It was also a sound of loss. "It's God's! This baby belongs to God!" She fell to the ground in a heap. Alan held her. We were all in various stages of shock and tears. Me? I was jealous. All my scenes were emotional, well, explored, I thought. But this was next level. I was broken, and my brokenness brought me here to acting, to New York, to wanting to heal and live and feel alive. Stanislavski, Sanford Meisner, Stella Adler, all teachers from the famed actor studio said to study life. It's those moments that you study in life that get injected into your work. You're creating human beings. You're not just creating a different walk, a different manner of speech, and a different emotional life. Circle in the Square pulled that home for me, and they did it with love. Alan Langdon is still teaching at Circle in the Square Theater. After the 6-week summer program, they asked one student to join their theater. They asked me. I declined, saying, "Circle in the Square is a great training program, but I want a program where I can get a job afterward. I wanted a training program where I knew that as soon as I finished, I would be working as an actor, that I would have an agent. Without an agent, you don't get jobs. I wanted to be able to say that I trained as an actor, now I'm working as an actor. I wanted to be assured I'd have a paycheck to cover my bills, put food on the table. I didn't want to go back to Central Falls." I asked Mark, another good friend of mine who was in the program at the time, "What program can I get into where at the end of it we're auditioning for people who can actually get you a job?" "Well, those would be Juilliard, Yale, and NYU, Viola. Those are the programs, and maybe SUNY Purchase, where they have auditions in the fourth year," he replied. "They called them league auditions back in the day, because there was a league of 13 schools. But now, only these 4 invite agents and casting directors from all over for your fourth year auditions." Toward the end of my gap year, I applied to Juilliard, one of the 4 Mark named. I would have applied to all 3 schools, but I only had money for 1 application fee. People have asked if I got connected at Circle in the Square, if I developed a network from being there. I suppose there was an acting network in New York, but I've realized there is no true network, no rhyme or reason or textbook way of getting into this business, except finally getting a job that leads to the next job and the next. I decided my next move was to get training at one of the programs Mark told me about, but I had missed my boat to be accepted and enrolled for the coming year in any of them. I decided to take a gap year. I knew I needed to grow up. Circle in the Square Theater is smack dab in the middle of Manhattan. I was taking the subway on my own. I was living in an apartment in Gramercy Park with 2 friends from Rhode Island College. I never had sex, never had a boyfriend, never lived on my own, never traveled overseas. I just wanted to grow up. I wanted to experience life. I wanted my life to be as expansive as I felt my mind was, my imagination was. I remember praying. I was a non-church-going person, but I had started praying when I was younger before bed every night in order to sleep, to calm my anxiety. I prayed harder when my father was beating my mama, especially when it got bloody or brutal. I prayed when he slit her arm open. I prayed when he stabbed her in her leg or in the neck with a pencil. It's all I could think to do. Now at 21, I prayed that my life would manifest in a way that made me worthy to become a professional actress, travel out of the country, and get a boyfriend. In that year off, I became a professional actress. My first professional production was in Providence, Rhode Island, at Trinity Repertory Company, in August Wilson's Joe Turner's Come and Gone. After I came back from those 6 weeks training at Circle in the Square Theater in New York, I acted at Trinity Rep for a year. The artistic director was Adrian Hall. I had auditioned for him, knew him. He had seen my work. He retired during my gap year, but we did maybe 3 plays together. After he retired, director Susan Lawson, whose shitty apartment in New York I would later sublease when I went to Juilliard, took over for him. I juggled a day job and a night job. I returned to work at Providence Performing Arts Center as a telemarketer during the day. The Trinity Rep performances were at night, so I had my days free. The acting training of humiliation, rejection at the Performing Arts Center by day, then actually performing professionally in a play at night. Danielle, who was by then 11, and I became even closer during my gap year. Although I had a roommate at the time, sometimes she would sleep over. Or I would sleep at my mom's house on the floor with her because my mom and my daddy's apartment was so small. That's why I got my own apartment in Pawtucket. My roommate was a very nice friend of a friend, and the apartment was beautiful. The landlord, however, was a raging racist. I haven't met anyone like her since. She was Brazilian. Aghast when I moved in. She thought I was a prostitute because she saw me waiting for a bus. When my roommate, who was the only one she would talk to, said I was an actress, she didn't know what that meant. She said I wasn't allowed to have visitors, even my little sister, because black kids destroy property. She said she was terrified of being raped and killed by me or any black man I invited over. She kept a baseball bat near her door. Many years later, after I moved to Los Angeles, I came home to visit. And during a trip to the mall, I saw a woman selling jewelry at a pop-up shop. It was her. "Where are you from?" I asked, and she replied, "Brazil, sweetheart." She proceeded to be extraordinarily kind. I put her on the list of racists who like blacks from a distance. By then, I understood that housing redlining was a part of our culture, North and South, affected by Jim Crow. Whether you have an education or not, the ugliness of racism comes down like a hammer. It enveloped my life when I was 8, and at 23, I was still bullied by it. When you have little to no money, there's no way to combat it. Where could I live? My sister Dolores was living with her boyfriend, soon to be husband, in a one-bedroom apartment. My sister Diane lived in Maryland, and my sister Anita had 2 children and was having her own challenges. I wish I had had the power, resources at that time, to tell that racist woman to shove her apartment up her ass. But my ass would have been on my parents' floor. That was like being sentenced to live out my childhood again. I was still running. In Joe Turner's Come and Gone, there's a role for an 11-year-old girl, Zonia. Danielle auditioned for it and got the role. This was in a professional production directed by Israel Hicks, who is probably one of the greatest theater directors in the business. Terrific actors came in from New York. It was a great production. Danielle thrived in it and got great reviews from the Boston Globe, the Providence Journal, and several other newspapers. She was also getting straight A's in school. After school, she would take the bus from Central Falls to downtown Providence for rehearsals, and once we were in production, she would take the bus to make it to the theater on time. Man, we were still running for buses all the time. I could easily make Danielle run by egging her on. "Danielle, the fastest runner in Central Falls!" At night, after the play and we were exhausted, I would take her back home on the bus and stay with her at my mom's house because it was too late to walk to my own apartment, which was close to mom's. A lot of the fighting between my parents had subsided by this point, although the alcoholism was still rampant. While rehearsing Joe Turner's Come and Gone at Trinity Rep, 2 big events happened. I auditioned for Juilliard, and I met David, the man in my life for the next 7 years. David was in the play. David played Jeremy and I played the role of Molly. He was a professional actor who came from Boston. To me, it was like meeting a black Marlon Brando. He was a great actor. I saw him. He came to me. I thought I was completely, absolutely, without question, in love. He was my first boyfriend. David was older and blacker than black. He had immersed himself in black history and black consciousness and black literature. His favorite type of music was jazz. He was also a film enthusiast. He would start watching films early in the morning and wouldn't stop until the next day. His harmonica or mouth harp skills were spectacular. It all made me feel so, so grown. We would go out after the play to the bar next door. We bonded over a Long Island iced tea. I liked Long Island iced tea because the drink actually tasted like iced tea. I would only have one. I was a 23-year-old big girl now, and a professional actress using the lingo, doing what professional actors do, hanging out with experienced actors. Once a play is running, you have your days free. That's when I traveled to New York City to audition for Juilliard. I wanted to be able to audition. An actor doesn't just show up and say, "I want the job." An agent is a conduit, the connection between talent and work. Not all agents are created equal. Some agents can get you in an audition for one line on a TV show. My goal was to attend Juilliard and graduate with a top-notch agent. I got my ass on that train in Providence to New York City, thinking I would knock out the audition and make it back for my 7:30 p.m. call for Joe Turner's Come and Gone at Trinity Rep. In theater, 7:30 p.m. is your half-hour call. That means you have to be at the theater at 7:30 p.m. That's when the stage manager does a roll call. That's like marking your timesheet. You have to be in your dressing room at 7:30 p.m. I had no idea that when you audition to get in Juilliard, the auditions take place over 3 days. I found that out much later after trading admission stories with classmates. I didn't even know Juilliard was a 4-year program. Yale is 3 years, NYU is 3 years. I was simply intent on going to a school where I could get more training and then an agent, and I wanted to get better. Ignorant of the 3-day audition regime, when I received my audition slot, I allocated 1 day thinking, well, I'll just go up for the day and tell them, you're going to tell me now whether I'm in or I'm out because I have to get back. I have to get back on the train. It took 4.5 hours to get there, 4.5 hours back, and a half hour from Penn Station to Juilliard, which is Midtown Manhattan, at 66th Street and Broadway. I had just 45 minutes to devote to the audition. I was pretty confident that I was going to get into Juilliard because I didn't know better. I felt I had power in my acting. I had a feeling I was good. The longer I had been in theater settings, the more confident I became. And New York City was very easy for me to navigate, even coming from Central Falls, Rhode Island. The day I went to my Juilliard audition, the clock was ticking. I got on the first train smoking and arrived early. I weighed about 165 pounds and was nervous, sitting in a room with dozens of skinny actors who had been in magnet school since they were 2 years old, dance classes since they were toddlers, all warming up, doing their ballet techniques. I sat there, waiting my turn. I had no sense of what to wear, so I had on puffy jeans, a huge red sweater, and a head wrap that had wide silver, purple, and gold sparkles. I was too inexperienced to understand that any of that could be a distraction from my performance. My two audition pieces were lines of Celie in the Color Purple and Something from The Learned Lady by Molière. You needed a contemporary and a classical piece, usually 3.5 minutes at the most.
That's a true monologue. Sometimes you get a little longer, but that's usually the standard. I was confident in my pieces. At Juilliard, you audition for 3 or 4 main teachers, and if you're good enough, you go on to the next level and do your audition again. Then you go to the next level, and you audition again until the entire faculty has seen you. Then there are interviews. Applicants stayed in hotels, allowing time for all of that. I only had 45 minutes and no idea how unorthodox that was. I did my monologues, then said, "Thank you," and returned to the room filled with actors who looked like they had been in training for this moment since they were 2 years old. The atmosphere is staunch, authoritative hierarchy. The faculty are the boss and absolutely strict about classical training. You speak when you're spoken to. I put my hair rag back on and said, "I just thought you should know I've got 45 minutes. I'm doing a play in Providence. My half-hour call is at 7:30. It's a 4.5-hour train ride. You have to tell me whether I'm in or out." I can't believe I said that. They looked shocked, as if I pimp-slapped them. But they said, "Okay, just stand by." I sat in that room feeling out of place. Everybody's doing their vocal training at the same time, screaming, yelling, yelping, doing their yoga moves, all that shit. I'm trying to sit quietly in the corner and look into the hallway as the teachers and the head of the school pick up their chairs. Later, I learned they carried their chairs into the biggest training room at Juilliard, room 103. I heard whispers, "What's going on? What's going on?" Then someone called me. The teachers had fast-tracked me. Instead of waiting 3 days, I was asked to do my audition again for all the teachers of all the departments in one room. When they called me in, "Okay, Viola in 5 minutes," I knew I had undivided attention in that damn room with everybody. I did my audition for all of them. They interviewed me, the head of the department, who, by the way, was an asshole, great director, great interpreter of Shakespeare, but an asshole. Michael Langham, director of Stratford Festival in Canada for many years, said, "There are things you have to work on, but we see your gift as an actor, your emotional wealth." "Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you," I said. Looking back, I see I wanted to say, "Hurry the fuck up and just let me know if I got in because I have to get on that train. I gotta go." But I knew I had gotten in. I ran for the train and made it back on time. Getting into a school is usually a wonderful story that's the equivalent of falling in love, of being on the honeymoon. There's a difference between falling in love and actually being in the marriage. By the time I received the acceptance letter, I already knew I had gotten in. By the time I got to Juilliard, I was already in the marriage. The magic and excitement of the audition was backburnered, a long-forgotten dream. I wish I could have held on to the fact that my audition was badass. Back in Providence, David loved Danielle. He loved kids in general. He already had one from a prior relationship. During breaks in rehearsal, we would all get the most magnificent sandwiches from Mark's Deli. After the performance at night, I would take Danielle home and walk back to my apartment. Because Danielle was underage, 11, another actress would play the role of Zonia 4 performances a week. They would switch. On the nights Danielle didn't perform, I would stay with David. As much as I would love to romanticize that part of my life, I can't. I was so unfinished. I asked God for a boyfriend, professional acting status, and the experience of traveling overseas. But I didn't ask for wisdom. I didn't ask for self-love. And it showed. I was with a man who never loved me. My objective the entire 7 years was earning his love.
I would internally pray, convincing myself that this would be the day he'd profess that he couldn't live without me. This would be the day he'd just look at me and tell me I'm beautiful. I practically gave him VIP access to relationships with other women. I felt lucky to have him. That's how damaged I was. He never remembered my birthday, my favorite foods, Christmas, Valentine's Day. I was into the outward marks of achievement rather than the inner sense of home with a man, a sense of belonging to oneself. He wasn't a great boyfriend, but I didn't demand anything from him. I didn't create any boundaries. I didn't teach him how to treat me. So I wasn't the best girlfriend. I used to be secretly jealous of people who were even in bad relationships. I would hear women say, "Yeah, he was begging me to take him back after he cheated on me. He was crying, going on and on about how much he loved me and wanted me, so I took him back." My thought was, "He cried and said he wanted you and loved you?" I never heard that in 7 years. But it was not David. It was me. Before I met David that gap year, I met someone else on the way to work. He became my first boyfriend who I never talk about. His name was Carl, and he was a wayward soul. Our connection started with him telling me I was beautiful at the bus stop and me smiling. I never knew where he was, what he was doing, where he worked, nothing. I remember very little about him because he didn't stick around long. I slept with him 4 times. I'm ashamed because I have puritanical values that I was not admitting to. I'm ashamed also because the last time I was with him, I went to his house to tell him we're done. He wanted to have sex, and I most definitely didn't. I was on my period. We struggled. He kept pulling my pants down. I thought about punching him, but I didn't. Maybe that would have been an acknowledgement that what was happening was rape. So I gave in, and afterward left, ashamed. That's how I felt. But what I showed was a young woman in control. I compartmentalized the trauma and filtered it so that it would lie to me and keep me safe. Another dirty secret, another shame lashing. Why didn't I punch his ass in the face? Why didn't I fight the same way 6-year-old Viola did when the boy next door tried to kiss and touch me in his house? 6-year-old me punched him as hard as I could. No apology. Hell, he kicked me hard afterward, but I got back up with tears to kick his ass again. Somehow, along the way, I guess I felt she was wrong. That in my journey to the top, to being more evolved, I left the street fighter behind. I left my claws. David was an out-of-town actor. Equity rules dictated that the theater had to provide him his own apartment for the duration of the play. I had another place to stay, to lay my head. I tapped into another part of my soul that identified me. My blackness. David was bold and unapologetic about it. He once saw a poll on the PBS show Tony Brown's Journal that said 80% of whites felt blacks were unpatriotic. It pissed him off so that he studied every war America has ever fought and researched African-American involvement in them. Every single war we fought in. Even during Jim Crow, when we were not nearly given the same rights as our white counterparts. That was patriotism. If that didn't speak volumes about our love and commitment to this country, nothing did. He also studied music, black history. Just before I went to Juilliard, David went to L.A. to do the Shakespeare play Measure for Measure at the Old Globe Theater in La Jolla. Then he moved back to Rhode Island to become a company member at Trinity Rep. During my years at Juilliard, every time I went home on the weekend or during holidays, I would stay with him in his apartment. David was an actor who worked a lot. I was the newbie actor, then acting student. In that gap year, I was also working as a telemarketer at PPAC, Providence Performing Arts Center, selling tickets over the phone while doing play after play after play at Trinity Rep. I was finally a working actor, not making bank, but enough to get by, to live. Rhode Island didn't have a high cost of living. I didn't have a car, but I had my own apartment with a roommate. I could buy food. I could do all that I needed to get by. I was an overly busy working actor. But I didn't want to stay in Rhode Island. I wanted to grow, to travel. Toward the end of my gap year, I resigned from Trinity Rep and flew to Edinburgh, Scotland, where I performed 3 plays in the Fringe Festival. One of my mentors, Dr. Bill Hutchinson, filled out the application for us to enter. I went to Boston to get my first passport and was amazed at how my dreams were manifesting. It's the largest theater festival in the world. Emily Baker, whom I met at a 6-week acting program at Circle in the Square, loaned me the money to participate. She had written a play about her experience with her dad abusing her that she wanted me to perform. The other play I did was a comedy written by a theater teacher from Rhode Island College. I played Socrates' wife, who went into therapy because her husband never talked to her. He would just think all the time. The third was a play by another Rick teacher-director. I played the snake in a reinterpretation of Adam and Eve. I flew British Airways and stayed in an apartment on Sir Arthur Conan Doyle Drive in Edinburgh. We would walk to the theater from there, a long walk. During the day, we would visit the Mary Queen of Scots Castle, explore the city, eat fish and chips with malt vinegar. At night, we performed or saw other performances. A performance from the Traverse Theatre in Scotland was about men in a South African prison. They were naked the whole time, sometimes simulating sex. At one point, they go to the bathroom in a bucket and later in the play throw the contents at each other. There was either real poop on that stage or it was made of clay. I had to force myself to believe it was made of clay. No way could they time that out. It was riveting. And the surprise was the elderly people in the audience who were completely into it. I saw a production of Salome by the famous auteur director Stephen Brickoff. My favorite was the Festival d'Espana out of Barcelona. It was a pagan fireworks extravaganza on the grounds of an all-boys school. The school looked like a castle. The performers dressed like half-man, half-beast, with fire shooting out of their nostrils. Some had beast costumes on, pretending to hang clothes made of fire on clotheslines made of fire. Enormous phallic symbols shot fireworks out into the sky that exploded in the most magnificent display. My friend Doug Cooney and I looked at each other with gaping mouths. Doug was an acting student at Rhode Island College, and he played Socrates in one of our plays. I actually think we ran through the streets in laughter, exhilaration, and in awe at what we had just seen. It's the sheer supernatural power of artistry that is a life-giving, God-injected drug. When you are in the presence of it, you feel like you can fly. Nighttime was my favorite. Amid all the actors in a large apartment, talking, sharing, laughing, drinking scotch, playing spades, talking about the process of acting, I slowly felt like a part of something. Usually I clicked with one or two people in a group, but this time we were all together. I flew to San Diego after the Fringe Festival for a week with David, who was acting in a theater. Then I took a bus from San Diego to Los Angeles, stayed at my friend Gary's apartment, and planned to fly to New York to start my first day at Juilliard the next morning. I took a bus from San Diego to Los Angeles. Halfway through the trip, the bus abruptly stopped and police came in and removed 80% of the people on the bus for not having proper identification. We got into LA and I saw my friend Gary waving frantically. "Hey, Gary, get your bags and run." If I hadn't experienced it, I would call myself a liar. But a wave of displaced homeless people started enclosing us and grabbing. They were trying to grab my arm, bags. Gary got into the car. I threw my bags in and jumped in almost at the same time the car was moving. Someone should have told me, "Viola, you don't start your new life like that. Don't squeeze in the start of your new life." But I decided I'd fly into New York, dump my stuff in Susan Lawson's apartment, which I had sublet sight unseen, and go to my orientation. I took a cab from the airport, and when I arrived at the building, I thought, "Oh, okay, the outside looks like crap, but it's Susan Lawson's apartment." I lugged all my suitcases to the fourth floor walk-up. When I opened the door, I stood in that doorway for 20 minutes. I kid you not. It was a traumatic experience, like having dissociative disorder. I dumped my stuff in the apartment, completely depressed, almost catatonic. I took the subway to Juilliard to start my orientation. I was about to go into the belly of the beast. Juilliard was about to rip apart my world. I would come face to face, not with God, but with me.